From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American Marines yesterday confiscated over 3,000 Iraqi chemical warfare suits and gas masks in a hospital in the battleground town of Nasiriyah. That discovery has provided the strongest suggestion yet that Iraq is preparing for chemical or biological warfare. Units from the 101st U.S. Airborne Division are now one tank of fuel away from Baghdad, their commander said today. And soldiers are wearing their ChemBio suits 24-7. Nerve gas, anthrax, mustard gas, sarin, any or all could await them on the road to Baghdad. Tonight, On Point, the chips are down for Saddam. Will he go ChemBio? And if he does, how will the U.S. respond? We begin with the latest from Washington. John Diamond is Pentagon correspondent for USA Today. Good evening, John Diamond. Welcome.
Great to be back.
John Diamond, tell us about the, well, many developments today. Foremost, perhaps, on our mind is this convoy of 1,000 armored vehicles or more reportedly headed out of Baghdad today, headed toward U.S. troops. What's up?
A lot of conflicting reports about that. My conversation with the Pentagon within the hour raised some questions about just what this movement of vehicles is. There are some sources over at Central Command in Doha, Qatar, who are essentially confirming reports that there is some movement south through Baghdad of members of the Republican Guard to reinforce the Medina Division Republican Guardsmen who've been under heavy assault south of Baghdad and who are facing an oncoming U.S. Army. But there clearly is some reinforcement going on, but at this point, I'm not sure that this 1,000-vehicle convoy is really happening. And the one of the issues about this, of course, if there were such a thing, and if it were identifiable as a military convoy, it would be immediately vulnerable to a withering attack from above that would bring to mind the famous Highway of Death incident in the first Persian Gulf War.
In Kuwait. Well, that was our thought as well, John Diamond. How does a report like this get out into such wide circulation? I mean, a 1,000-vehicle convoy, you would think it's either there or it's not. How
well,
can it be confusing?
There's an echo chamber going on in the cable television media right now, which is so competitive, and reports are getting out with very thin, shaky sourcing, and they're getting bounced around, picked up, matched, and so forth, before there's absolute clarity on these things. So it may, in fact, prove to be true that there was some sort of movement through Baghdad. It's just not clear yet. I've had some indications that it could just be civilians on the move to get out of the city as a battle approaches. But there is some belief out of Doha that there are Republican guardsmen trying to move south under the cover of this sandstorm, which is still lingering in the area today, to get down to provide some reinforcements. Now, the number of 1,000 does come up in a more confirmed way up to the north, where 1,000 U.S. paratroopers from the 173rd Airborne Brigade based in Italy have taken an air base in northern Iraq.
This is a big airdrop and perhaps the opening of a long-awaited northern front?
Right. It would be a much constricted northern front as compared to the 62,000 forces that were going to come through Turkey had Turkey granted permission for that to happen.
What can, what might the U.S. do with 1,000 troops in the north?
Well, unless that is the vanguard of a much larger airborne force to follow, that would be a force able to do something like secure a base for supplies, conduct security at particular oil fields. I don't think that 1,000 troopers are going to come out of northern Iraq and pose a threat to Baghdad itself. That could only happen if there were substantial reinforcements.
So not really a front. What about the bombing in Baghdad itself today? Reports of a U.S. missile landing in an Iraqi marketplace and quite a few civilian casualties.
Right. Again, finding the absolute truth in these things extremely difficult. The Pentagon is leaving open the possibility that it was one of their bombs or missiles that caused that damage. But U.S. reporters who were in Baghdad and got to that scene reported finding no evidence of parts of missiles, which, of course, you can imagine would have been paraded for the media had they been found. And there had been reports in the past couple of days that Iraq was planting explosives on buses to cause damage such as this that then could be blamed on the U.S., and that they were going to be setting these off in perhaps Shia neighborhoods that aren't necessarily loyal to Saddam anyway.
Very hard to sort out, but the bodies were there. There was no question. There were, 30, it appeared, or something on that order, dead Iraqi civilians.
The last number I saw was 15, but you could have a more recent.
No, you may be right.
Yep.
What about the troops then? U.S. troops now not surrounding, but certainly clustering in large numbers closer and closer to Baghdad. Have they been fighting with Iraqi troops today? Is there sign of a U.S. advance, or are they still hunkered down in the sand?
They are, I would say, grouping and positioning themselves for an upcoming battle. They're getting into what I would say are hold positions. And I think there is probably going to be a pause of at least a day or two, especially with this sandstorm, because the indications we're getting from Central Command are that there's going to be a substantial softening up, if you will, of Republican Guard positions south of Baghdad.
That is bombing.
That's bombing. That's killing people. And to the extent that there are Republican Guard troops in identifiable military positions separate and apart from civilian areas, they're likely to come under heavy attack. The goal is to do as much damage to this force as possible before taking it on the ground.
Central Iraq, Najaf, Nasiriya, conflicts there today or not?
Still some conflicts, as well as in Najaf, which is now surrounded. These are towns on the route to Baghdad from Kuwait, and which have posed a persistent risk to the convoys of fuel and ammunition moving north to the troops surrounding the southern reaches of Baghdad. And there's still some tough fighting going on there, although we are hearing indications that the Brits have moved into Basra and quieted things down, that Qasr is quiet.
The port quiet. Basra, meaning they've actually gone into the city? Yesterday they were surrounding the city.
Surrounding the city. Some indication that that there's been some movement into the city. There are likely to be some rapid developments in these places in the next few days.
But no confirmation today. In fact, backtracking on the reports that we had yesterday from others and yourself of an uprising in Basra.
Right, that's right. And some of the Shia groups outside of Iraq were also denying that. So again, a lot of fog of war going on, but the feeling from the Pentagon and from Central Command is that the cities on the route to Baghdad are more secure now. They're gradually becoming more secure. The Pentagon has indicated that there is somewhat of a shift in emphasis, at least right now, to securing these cities and providing forces necessary to do that. Rather than charging straight into center city Baghdad.
John Diamond, we're talking tonight about the chemical and biological attack threat as U.S. troops approach Baghdad, which could well be the site of Saddam Hussein's last stand, who knows, but they will once again be clustering, be gathering. Is there concern that that makes them, again, vulnerable, as they were on the Kuwaiti border, to potential chemical and biological attack?
There's always hazards, but these troops are well equipped. The consensus seems to be that the real danger is to the Iraqi population, because there's simply no way to protect them in the event of some of this material being used, which is, of course, susceptible to the whims of the particular wind direction in a given moment. And obviously this stuff is lethal and extremely dangerous, but the American troops are well equipped, and it's what we have now are only indications. There are scattered intelligence pickups that the Iraqis have some sort of red line, which, if crossed, would cause them to use these weapons. There was this find of 3,000 chemical protective suits at the hospital.
Do U.S. officials doubt that the Iraqis would use chemical or biological weapons at this point?
No, I think the posture is they're cautiously preparing for the possibility. But there's just, and the troops have the gear, they have the MOP gear, they're all geared up. Most of them are wearing it in rather than take the time to put it on in an emergency. Mm-hmm. But there's just no consensus, and the emphasis in recent days has not been so much on will Saddam use it as on can we find it? In other words, can the United States forces and the coalition forces find any evidence that would back up the main justification for this invasion in the first place?
So many angles on this chem bio front. John Diamond, thank you for joining us tonight. Great having you.
You're welcome.
John Diamond is Pentagon correspondent for USA Today. He joined us from Washington. Across Iraq, American-led troops are dressed head-to-toe now in chemical warfare suits, sweltering in temperatures approaching 100 degrees, fending off sandstorms. Their next stop is the Iraqi capital. What is quite possibly Saddam Hussein's last stand lies immediately ahead. And so does the very real threat of chemical and biological attack. The Iraqis have done it before. At this point, the question may be, what would stop them now? Are American troops ready, and how would they respond? We may know soon. The crucial moment could be just days or hours away. Do you have any reason to think that Saddam Hussein will not use chemical or biological weapons on U.S. troops threatening his regime and his life? And if he does, how should U.S. forces respond? What will we learn if the gas is dropped? We're joined. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined now in the studio by Rocco Casagrande, former chief of the Biological Analysis Lab for the UN Monitoring, Verification, and Inspection Commission, referred to as UNMOVIC. He was in Iraq from last December until March 4th of this year. Good evening and welcome, Rocco Casagrande.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Good to have you back. And with us from Newport, Rhode Island tonight is John Ballard, professor of joint military operations at the Naval War College. He participated in the Pentagon's war games planning for the war in Iraq. Good evening and welcome, John Ballard.
Hello, Tom. Good to be here.
Thanks for joining us. Rocco Casagrande, you've been in Iraq very recently, looking as closely as anyone could at the evidence, lack of evidence, you tell us, of chemical and biological weapons there or weapons material. I guess straight from the top, you were there, you've been watching, you've been thinking closely about it on the UN inspections team. Do you believe that this is a real threat, that Iraq may still, at this point, despite denials, have the materials for chemical and biological warfare?
Well, it wasn't the idea for that didn't come from anything particular found on inspection. It's how Iraq has behaved for the last 12 years. In 1991, they denied having any biological weapons program, and then UNSCOM, the previous inspection regime, accumulated enough evidence that suggested that, in fact, they did have a biological weapons program. So in 1995, Iraq changed course and then admitted to having a biological weapons program.
Granted, your mission didn't find solid evidence one way or the other, but you're closer to it than we are. Is the pattern clear enough that it's a real and present concern, present danger for U.S. troops there now?
Yes, of course. I mean, it's something you have to consider because we knew they had them at the past and they've given no evidence whatsoever, no credible evidence that they've gotten rid of these.
And John Ballard, as you imagine, U.S. forces now around Iraqi population centers, including Baghdad, we just heard that they are prepared. But what does preparation mean? How are they prepared? And if this comes, is it so obvious that U.S. troops can fight right through it without damage?
The first issue about how are they prepared, there's a couple of things. First of all, they're prepared with equipment, you know, not only the chemical suits that you've heard about, mm-hmm. but the vehicles that have overpressure systems, and they also have units that are prepared to decontaminate the troops. Mm-hmm. The other thing that they have is their own training. In other words, they can protect themselves, and the units can respond to these sort of attacks on very short notice. So I think they're quite prepared for it, but it will change their operation.
If I could add to that, they're also vaccinated against most of the major biological threat agents.
That's correct.
So on the biological side, they should be fairly secure. Chemical side, Rocco Casagrande, still vulnerable if your gas mask isn't on straight, if you're too hot and have your shirt off?
Of course, yeah. A lot of the, unlike biological agents, the chemical agents have are very effective through the skin. So if you are splashed with this, any unprotected skin is a route of entry and effectiveness for these agents. A little drop of VX on the skin and you'll be dead in a few minutes.
We're going to talk tonight about what exactly might be out there, how ready the U.S. is to face it, and how it might change the face of the war and impressions of the war if and when a chem bio attack comes. Will Saddam use chemical or biological weapons, and how will the U.S. respond? You can join the conversation. Has stiffer than expected Iraqi resistance made U.S. troops now sitting ducks for such an attack? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the chem-bio threat in Iraq. Will Saddam use chemical or biological weapons, and how would the U.S. respond? You can join the conversation tonight. If Iraq does use chemical or biological weapons on American troops, how should the U.S. respond? And Gulf War vets, do you remember the threat, the fear of chem-bio attack on the battlefield? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guest tonight, Rocco Casagrande, former chief of the Biological Analysis Lab for UN Weapons Inspections, came back from Iraq less than a month ago. And from Newport, Rhode Island tonight, John Ballard, a professor of joint military operations at the Naval War College, who participated in war games planning for this war in Iraq. We want to take a little bit closer look at the war. Right now, in the Iraqi desert, sandstorms have slowed progress of U.S. and allied troops to Baghdad. Soldiers with the 101st Airborne Division took shelter today at a refueling base in central Iraq, hunkering down to wait out the storm. Jim Dwyer is a correspondent with the New York Times, embedded with the 101st. I asked him how concerned soldiers are about the chemical biological threat in light of the reported discovery in Nasiriyah of Iraqi chemical suits and masks.
Ever since we crossed into Iraq, people have been very alert about that issue. And I'm sure that the discovery of those suits, if it's verified, will add to those concerns. A lot of the initial information that comes out when it's scrutinized a little further often has a different shape and meaning. I'm not saying that these findings yesterday are not significant or are not alarming, but I think it's important to realize that there's just an awful lot of confusion in the battlefield. There's a lot of messages that come back that get passed through three or four hands, and they take turns as they travel. So people are already alert and are already prepared for that kind of activity. Everybody who crosses into Iraq wears them. The suits are not actually so bad today or even in the evening at all, because the weather actually has been pretty cool the last few days, although yesterday it did get up around 96. But today it's blowing all day long pretty hard, and the suits are actually pretty comfortable in this weather.
Jim Dwyer, can you describe whatever contact the unit you're with may have had with Iraqi troops in the last day or two? Have you had contact?
No, we're in an area where there's just tremendous sandstorms, and the 101st Airborne, which is the group I'm traveling with, is primarily a helicopter attack organization, and they are not flying anywhere because you can't see 10 feet, really. There's been some activity around the perimeter of the camp or the base where we're located, apparently some snipers and supposedly some artillery firing. I have not heard any of the artillery firing, and I also didn't hear any snipers shooting, thankfully. Because of the weather, what has happened here is the 101st has taken this lull, so to speak, to reinforce their encampment here, and they've got bulldozers and they're doing all kinds of stuff to make it more secure.
What's the immediate physical setting of the camp? What's the terrain, Jim?
We're in the most godforsaken desert you'd ever want to see. It's barren as far as the eye can see, and the soil is quite loose. It's very sandy and dusty. No matter where you go, if you're inside a tent or if you're inside a Humvee or wherever you are, you're quickly encrusted with sand, and you stay that way pretty much morning, noon, and night. People actually sleep with these gaiters, these brown, kind of like a scarf thing that you pull up over your nose and your mouth to try and filter out some of the sand, and you wear goggles all the time because your eyes are constantly filling up with it. With my laptop and stuff, I can't read the keys. You dust it off every 20 minutes or so, and, you know, before you type the next sentence, there's another fine layer of dust around. visibility is starting to improve a little bit, but it's still, I would say, less than 100 yards. Most of the time, it's only been about 20 or 30 feet at the most. We're supposed to get a break in the wind tonight, and I'm looking forward to breathing actual oxygen for a while instead of sand.
Jim, we've got the picture. It sounds like a rough scene there. We thank you for joining us, and be well.
Okay, Tom. Bye now.
Jim Dwyer is correspondent with the New York Times and is with the 101st Airborne Division. He spoke with us from central Iraq, 50 to 100 miles south of Baghdad. John Ballard, Rocco Casagrande, you can hear there. There's the awareness of the threat. People, troops, have their gear nearby all the time. Yesterday in Washington, John Ballard, senior administration officials were quoted saying that they believe that the Iraqi leadership may be holding chemical weapons in reserve until American forces approach Baghdad. The Pentagon officials said that Iraqi prisoners of war have been captured in recent days carrying gas masks, that Pentagon officials believe that weapons may be intended for use when American forces are in close quarters, i.e. closing on Baghdad. How real do you believe this threat is?
I think it's very real. I think the evidence that you cite, the troops carrying gas masks and the suits that were found in the hospital, may not be directly tied to this. That could be just part of their normal dispositions and training. But I think the most logical time for the use of something like this would be in an act of desperation to defend against Baghdad. I don't honestly think that Saddam will do that, because I think that would destroy his strategic picture, but I think the risk does exist for some commanders at some levels to use these things.
Now, that's interesting, because, of course, the thought has always been that he would hold the final say on that. There's a lot of talk about his close aide, Ali Hassan al-Majid, his nickname in the West, at least, Chemical Ali, who was the one who used chemicals on Kurds 15 years ago, killed 5,000 in Halabja. He's still active. But you're saying that you don't think Saddam Hussein himself would do it for strategic reasons. Are you talking there about world opinion?
Yes. In other words, not as much world opinion, but the allegiance of the rest of the Arab world and others. I think that that would greatly reduce his stature if he actually did do this once he said that he did not have the capability. I think it's much more likely that a commander at a lower level would do it as an act of desperation or an act of confusion now that Saddam may have released the authority to use these weapons to other people.
We'll talk about how that might unfold, but Rocco Casagrande, your thoughts first. Given the position that Iraq has taken, that you must have heard firsthand from Iraqi officials in Baghdad and around the country, would this be a kind of shocking about-face for them to suddenly roll out weapons in war?
No, and I think we can take a lesson from history on that question, because in 1991, Iraq admitted later on that during the Gulf War, they had deployed biological weapons, R-400 aerial bombs and Al-Hussein missiles loaded with biological agent for use on coalition forces if they were threatening to topple the Iraqi regime. So they were intending to use it in the past to protect themselves. I don't see why they wouldn't use it currently.
But this time, as John Ballard says, they have said loud and clear and long, we do not have these weapons. Wouldn't that be a hit to their global standing, even as John Ballard says, in the Arab community?
Of course it would, but I think they would use them when they think that there's nothing to lose, as a final from hell's heart I stab at thee kind of dying revenge.
Rocco Casagrande, we want to understand just a bit, not to dwell on gory detail, but on the biological front, first of all, do the vaccinations really cover the waterfront? Are U.S. soldiers, in fact, immune from biological attack?
No. They're only immune, and they're actually not even entirely immune. They're only somewhat protected against agents that they're vaccinated against.
Those are?
Well, they're vaccinated, we know, against anthrax, and there's questions about how effective the U.S. anthrax vaccine is. And they're vaccinated against many other agents, which we don't need to get into. There's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
However, Iraq may not use those agents.
So they could use something else. Let's stick with biological for a second. If that's used in a setting that is in or abuts a civilian setting, are those Iraqi troops equally vulnerable?
Of course, they're more acutely vulnerable because civilians probably don't have respiratory protection to prevent them from breathing in the agents. They're almost certainly not vaccinated. And also, they probably don't have access to medical treatment, even if they knew they were attacked, to prevent disease from progressing. For example, if you know you're attacked, by anthrax, you can start taking antibiotics immediately and greatly reduce your chances of succumbing to the disease.
But if you don't have a medicine chest full of Cipro, you're not in position to do that. What about on the chemical side? First of all, what's the range of real threats or potential threats here? Mm-hmm. And what kind of killers are these? Is this a kind of one drop and you're dead? Is there time to save a soldier who's somehow been exposed to chemical weapons?
Right. So Iraq has used a number of – well, has claimed to have a number of different types of chemical agents. But we can center on both blister agents and nerve agents. Blister agents are things like mustard, which they used against the Kurds, which are
– And used all the way back to World War I's trenches.
Exactly. Which basically anywhere they contact the skin or any of the mucosal surfaces of the body, they cause blistering, which is kind of like as if that part of the body was burned.
Lethal blistering?
Of course. If you breathe it into the lungs, your lungs basically cease to function because they fill up with fluid. Mm-hmm. In the case of nerve agents such as VX and sarin, which Iraq did claim to produce VX, and they can't account for about 55 tons of VX precursor. VX is an extremely lethal nerve agent. Less than a drop on the skin will kill you, and it kills you by preventing your nerves from ceasing firing. So your body just goes into normal overload and dies. All your systems basically shut down.
How quickly?
Very quickly. Minutes.
Minutes.
Yes.
That's fast. John Ballard, you were involved in war games in advance of this war. Was this taken seriously into account, and what kind of ready response tactically, I guess, do U.S. troops have to this kind of attack? Do they retreat? Do they forge? Do they plow ahead? What do you do?
Oh, it certainly was taken into consideration, and there's a number of different options that have already been developed to do this. It's really difficult to say what they would do. It depends upon how the agent is applied, whether it is chemical or biological, and whether it's applied in the midst of another kind of attack or in isolation. Obviously, the worst case would be an attack very close to civilian areas. As we've discussed, they won't have any protection, and their casualties would overload any sort of medical treatment that might be available. And certainly, if they did that in combination with another sort of attack where you had other kinds of damage that would penetrate the suits and the protective equipment.
Conventional attack.
Yes, obviously.
So, I guess that the question then is, what is the typical or possible means of delivery for these weapons? Can they be tossed in by artillery shells or something else?
Well, certainly they can be provided by artillery. We also think they have the ability to put them by unpiloted vehicle, aerosol spray.
So this is the kind of drone that would come over, an aerosol with chemical or biological or either?
Principally, that would be probably biological, but it's hard to say. I'm not really sure how much of this stuff they've been able to develop into the ability to use it, actually, to develop the full agent.
And maybe no one knows. Rocco Casagrande, John Ballard, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation retired Brigadier General, U.S. Army General John Ruppert. He joins us from Cambridge, Massachusetts tonight. He's now Executive Director of Research at the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Good evening and welcome, General John Ruppert.
Good evening.
General Ruppert, you've heard some of this conversation. I guess, number one, do you see chemical and or biological attack as real risks? And number two, if it should come, how do you anticipate the U.S. military will respond?
Well, in terms of the reality of a chemical weapons attack, as was pointed out earlier, it is most likely part of a final defensive fire that they have nothing to lose. They know what the outcome is. You have 48 hours to live. Hit the Americans, the coalition, with everything that you have. Mm-hmm. There's an interesting twist to that, though, and that is that since Saddam Hussein or his successor cannot actually fire any of these weapons, they are largely artillery delivered, then you have to rely on troops that are out in the field army.
I mean, they don't have their finger actually on the trigger. Someone else has to pull that trigger.
That's right. Someone else is going to have to fire those weapons. And the people firing the weapons are going to have that same knowledge. The leadership has only 48 hours to live. Do we want to take that order and be labeled as war criminals because they'll know where the rounds came from? Or do we want to ignore that order for 48 hours and go home free.
Is that a real threat? The president and others in the U.S. administration have clearly made statements hoping to scare Iraqi commanders with that. But will it be so obvious? And in the case of, let's say, Ali Hassan al-Majid, he's already bombed Kurds with these weapons. He may very well face trial or imprisonment or worse, whether he launches this or not. Are there not commanders in such close proximity to Saddam's kind of indicted circle that they also have nothing to lose?
Well, those commanders, in fact, probably will be held accountable, but those are also not the people who control the artillery tubes.
Mm-hmm.
That is done at the battery level, at the battalion level, and those are the people that will actually have to fire those weapons.
And you believe that U.S. forces could, in a post-war situation, track down the individuals who gave the order, who pulled the trigger?
I think absolutely so, and in many cases we already know who they are and where they are and have communicated with them to say, we know that you have these artillery tubes. If you are issued these weapons of mass destruction and you fire them, we are holding you personally accountable.
Absolutely true.
Sabrina is calling from Goldboro, North Carolina. Hello, Sabrina. You're on the air.
Hey.
Good evening.
Good evening.
What's on your mind, Sabrina?
I just feel that if they had any sense at all, they would know to back out, because we have been through so much, and I don't want any of the troops to get injured or killed. So
you're saying if they had any sense at all, they would what, Sabrina?
They would back off over there in Baghdad.
You mean the Iraqis would stand down and not use these weapons?
Yeah.
Well, if, as you say, if they have any sense at all, but then there are many issues that come into play here. John Ruppert, let me put to you, and Sabrina, thank you for your call. John Ruppert, a point that John Ballard raised, that at the strategic level, Saddam Hussein no longer has an interest in using these weapons because it could turn world opinion against him. Is that likely to factor in these what may be final days?
Well, I think that the point that was made earlier that it is not a strategic weapon that is going to change the course of the war. It would only be used as a statement of revenge that we want to take other people because we are going to die as well. I can't imagine any scenario in which they would think that the use of these weapons would result in their achieving victory or even substantially impeding the course of the war.
And John Ballard, John Ruppert spoke about a kind of final unleashing of these at some point in time and geographically. Where is that? Is there a physical line that U.S. forces approach or cross? Is there a sense of a number of hours remaining that would be, well, if we're going to do it, let's do it now?
I don't think it's a sense of a number of hours. I agree exactly with what the general is saying. There's going to be a time where these Republican Guard forces are going to begin to crumble. It's going to be very obvious to the Iraqi leadership that their time in power is limited to less than 12 or 24 hours. And that might indeed be the time where they disregard anything that makes any sense and they simply do a revenge attack. That could occur over the next 3 or 4 days, depending upon how the battle commences. But that's clearly not our intention. Our intention is to separate these forces and isolate them and not allow the attack to crush down inside Baghdad.
Do we have the capacity to do that, to overrun Iraqi positions before they could use such weapons?
Well, what we're trying to do, first of all, is through information to communicate exactly what we said before, mm-hmm. that they should not do this, that their cause is lost, and that a fight to the death would be simply that and would not change the end game at all. The problem is it's very difficult to judge whether that's being effective or not.
We've got to take a short break. We're talking tonight about the chem bio threat in Iraq. Will Saddam use chemical or biological weapons, and how will the U.S. respond? If Saddam Hussein or Iraq does use these weapons, does it change your view of the rightness of the war itself? Can you imagine fighting in 90 or 100-degree heat in head-to-toe chem bio gear? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the chemical, biological weapons threat in Iraq as U.S. troops close on Baghdad. Do you think that a desperate Saddam Hussein will not use chemical or biological weapons on U.S. troops? And has stiffer than expected Iraqi resistance made U.S. troops sitting ducks for such an attack? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined in the studio by Rocco Casagrande, who until just a couple of weeks ago was chief biological analysis lab chief for the UN Monitoring, Verification, and Inspections Commission, the UN Weapons Inspectors in Iraq. From Newport, Rhode Island, by John Ballard, professor of joint military operations at the Naval War College, who participated in war games planning for this attack, and by General John Ruppert, former retired or brigadier general in the U.S. Army. You can join the conversation as well. Dan's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Can
Good
you hear
to have
me?
You. Loud and clear.
Okay. Actually, my comments have kind of evolved as I've listened to your speakers address the various issues. I think there's kind of a paradoxical benefit to the difficulties that the U.S. military is facing now.
How so?
In invasion, because it's reaffirming hope on Hussein's part that he can probably survive this invasion by winning a PR victory, mobilizing support that will eventually erode the U.S.'s position. My question is, which is something that you guys have spoken to, my question is, how exactly can we anticipate he's going to use those weapons? I was just weapons of mass destruction. I was just reading an article in the BBC that was reporting on, I think there were three scientists who were skeptical that the use of weapons of mass destruction could really have much effect on the battlefield. And I wonder if Hussein is in the position where finally he feels like the PR victory is no longer a promise and he has nothing to lose. Well, perhaps he's going to wonder, how can I inflict the greatest destruction, and on whom do I want to inflict that destruction? What he might do, instead of trying to use weapons against U.S. troops, he might perhaps have already or be in the process now of trying to plan for a kind of post-mortem revenge through terrorism in the U.S. homeland. Or perhaps I'm curious at what your guests think are some of the grim possibilities. Perhaps he's going to think, especially if the Shiites of the South, for example, do rise up, he's going to think, okay, well, these are very much my closest enemies, and the legacy I'll leave in my defeat will be to poison the marshlands all throughout the South.
One last smack on his way out. Dan, thanks for your call. Rocco Casagrande, I guess, first to this point of how transportable these weapons might be. If you've got U.S. troops pouring into Iraq, still it's a big country. If they're not used in the context of the war, could they sit out there? Could they be transported? Could they fall into other hands and be used later?
Sure. Like biological weapons have very limited utility against troops. Part of the reason is they have a long time to effect. The war might very well be likely over by the time any of our troops succumb to anthrax if they're used today, because it could take greater than a week for anyone to die of anthrax that's inhaled.
But are these huge vats of material? Are they small vials to be significant? Does it take a semi-trailer truck to get them out of the country?
On the battlefield, they tend to be huge vats. Like an R-400 bomb contains roughly 85 liters of agent. However, you can have an extremely useful terrorist weapon in something that could be the size of a scuba tank or even smaller, like a spray paint can.
And John Ballard, what about this notion of Saddam using weapons on some part of his civilian population? U.S. officials have said they fear he will do that, perhaps even in the South, as our caller Dan suggests, and blame it on American forces. Is that credible?
Well, I think it's only credible in the sense he's used these weapons before in his own population, but it could in no way be interpreted that we had used them. It's pretty easy to prove that we have not used them.
I can add to that, actually.
There's
a weapon that there's an agent that Iraq claimed to have weaponized called aflatoxin that they reason that they're using it because it has some kind of acute toxic effect. However, its toxic effect is much less than other agents they've weaponized. What aflatoxin does do pretty effectively is it causes cancer many, many years down the line after exposure. And that would be completely useless on the battlefield, but it would be an excellent revenge weapon to use on a population.
John Ruppert, what about the more immediate application here? If chemical weapons should be dropped on the battlefield, let's say in front of U.S. troops as they approach Baghdad. What happens? Can they create real widespread aerial denial? Do troops have to redirect or go around? What if there are large civilian casualties right in front of U.S. force? What does the force do in that case?
Well, in the first instance that you mentioned, we can bypass or, in fact, button up our armor equipment and drive through that with relatively little threat if we can decontaminate on the other side. The real problem would be if there are significant numbers of Iraqi casualties, say, on the outskirts of Baghdad, because we don't leave wounded people on the battlefield. If there are people that need medical treatment, we'll stop and provide all the medical treatment within our capacity.
But we could be talking about hundreds, thousands of Iraqi civilians in the teeth of a Republican Guard threat. Would the U.S. military really stop and open up a kind of a, I don't know, medical encampment?
Well, I mean, you would have to have a more specific scenario. Mm-hmm. If you know the Republican Guards are ahead of you, you're not under immediate attack, you do stop and treat wounded civilians, yes.
Mohammed's calling from Boston, Massachusetts. Hi, Mohammed, you're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My first question is, I wanted to know, nobody's talked a lot about how we can decontaminate or clean up environmentally these chemicals once they're used. How long do they last? And how far can the wind blow them?
Good questions, all. Rocco Casagrande, let me put that to you. There's been a sandstorm. Everybody says that in highly windy conditions, almost none of this is any use. It blows on by. But once it's still, if they're used, what is the cleanup process like? What does it require? How long does the threat remain? And how cleaned up can an area be once it's hit?
Right. So there's two different questions. One, there is how clean does an area have to be in order to provide no threat to someone moving through it? And the other one is, how clean does an area have to be before someone's willing to go shopping there again?
Mm-hmm.
And the first question is a lot easier to answer, in that there are decontamination materials. Bleach is very effective, for example, on many chemical agents that can get rid of enough of the material off the surfaces in order to prevent it being hazardous to anyone there.
So the agent will settle on a surface. It won't just float endlessly in the air.
Right. Like VX, for example, has the consistency of motor oil, and it settles out of the air quite rapidly.
But to go in with that bottle of bleach, do you have to be fully suited up in a chem-bio suit?
Yes.
Which civilians would not have.
Exactly. You'd need a decontamination team to clean up. You'd have to be fully suited in order to decon something.
Mm-hmm. And the longer term, to go shopping?
Right. Well, for something like anthrax, for example, which actually has a very low hazard once the cloud settles of anthrax, it has a very low hazard of someone walking through there, even if there is active spores lying around. It's just the fact that there is a chance of kicking up enough that someone will become ill and die from it. So getting rid of all of 10 trillion spores that may have settled in a one square block area is not an easy process.
So it could deny access to a particular area for
many years. I mean, yeah.
Years.
Yeah, it could. Like I said, it wouldn't be necessarily illogical. It wouldn't necessarily be a real hazard for someone walking through there. But people would still be scared of it, because you wouldn't to be able to detect trace amounts of live anthrax in that area for years to come.
John Ruppert, General Ruppert, we're coming to the end of our time here. Put this in context for us. We've been looking at the threat in isolation, but as U.S. forces press forward, does this change the strategy or the way that they approach Baghdad? Does it slow things down, or is it something that the commanders just say, well, it could happen, but until it does, we just push forward?
Well, you prepare for the contingencies in terms of the impact on the military units that have all of the gear that we can provide them, and on the military equipment that can be fairly effectively buttoned down. It's not going to affect the military units and their own movement and their activities. They would be, in fact, more inclined to speed up than slow down in those cases outside of the decon that was just mentioned. Mm-hmm. If, on the other hand, you hit civilian areas, you have large numbers of casualties, it does slow us down because we have an obligation to take care of those people.
And John Ballard, in the 20 seconds we have left, when does this threat go away? Is it still there after a victory? Is it still there during an occupation?
I'd say it's obviously still there after a victory until we've gone through and extensively searched for this sort of thing, particularly given the scenario that he might export it to some other terrorist group.
I want to thank all of you for illuminating the subject tonight. Let's hope it doesn't happen. Let's hope it doesn't come. Rocco Casagrande, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Tom.
Rocco Casagrande was former chief of the Biological Analysis Lab for UNOVIC, the UN weapons inspectors in Baghdad. Until just a couple of weeks ago, he's director of Homeland Security for APT Associates. John Ballard, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome.
John Ballard is professor of joint military operations at the Naval War College. And General John Ruppert, thanks for being along.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Just click on forums. In a moment, a call to save Iraq's cultural and archaeological treasures, even in war. This is On Point. As military planners consider which Iraqi sites to target in the air campaign, American archaeologists are weighing in with their own do-not-bomb list. Mesopotamia, ancient forerunner to Iraq, is regarded as a cradle of civilization. Archaeologist Gibson McGuire has been studying ancient artifacts in Iraq since the early 1960s. In this radio diary, McGuire assesses the threat to hundreds of thousands of ancient historical and cultural sites now in peril.
Most people have heard of a few of the sites that are in Mesopotamia. They've heard of Babylon. They've heard of Nineveh. They've heard of Ur of the Chaldees because they get it from the Bible. And that's as far as a lot of people get with it. And these are very important sites that we worry about in time of warfare. Now, we know the army in the Gulf War, in the first Gulf War, and the army now had lists of these famous sites, you know, and they made an attempt to not to damage those sites, just as they made an attempt in the Gulf War not to damage religious structures and other historic structures in the cities. And in fact, the bombing was pretty pinpoint in the cities. Some damage was done to a few of the sites. A few of the mosques were scarred with shrapnel and that sort of thing, but there were no direct hits on them, except for one mosque in Basra, which was damaged, but not totally destroyed. There was a very, very famous tourist site called the Abbasid Palace, which goes back to the 13th century, which was right backed up against the defense ministry, and the defense ministry was completely leveled, and the Abbasid Palace was not touched at all. But that doesn't mean it and other buildings weren't damaged, because just the shaking of the ground is like having mini earthquakes, which shook the ground and caused cracks to appear in the buildings. We know that there was some damage to the site of Ur, Ur of the Chaldees. There were four bomb craters in the site, and there was damage to the ziggurat, which is a big, solid mud brick and baked brick structure on which an ancient temple sat in ancient times. And this is the temple of the moon god. There are about 400 bullet holes in one side of that, but I know that that site was one that was on the list not to be touched. And except for that site and one other site that I know of, there was very little damage to the site as far as we can gauge. This time, I'm afraid there will be a lot more damage because the war is more general. The army didn't stop in just the south of the country as it did last time. They're going on into the entire country, and they are now approaching Baghdad. And the front line is more or less at this point at about Babylon, Kish, and sites of that sort. There's a whole string of very, very important sites that are just about at the front at this point. And as you get closer to Baghdad, more and more very important sites will be identified. People look at me and they say, well, how can you talk about these objects and these places when people's lives are in danger? And, you know, don't you have your priorities wrong? And I have to answer that by saying, you know, I've been going to the country for the last almost 40 years now, and I do have dozens and dozens of very close friends and acquaintances and colleagues, and I'm extraordinarily fond of the country. I'm very extraordinarily fond of the culture and the people. It's a wrenching experience to see this war go on. But at the same time, it is like watching the Bamiyan Buddhas be blown up in Afghanistan, although many, many people were already dead and being killed as those Buddhas were being blown up. It is the thing that caught the world's attention, because you are destroying a long, long-lasting piece of cultural heritage and world's cultural heritage. And so, you know, there are real worries in this thing, and that people must make some kind of attempt. And I think that in this case, the army is being very responsible and very admirable in trying to reduce casualties and trying to reduce damage to cultural property. But, you know, it is going to happen.
Gibson McGuire is professor of Mesopotamian archaeology at the University of Chicago's Oriental Institute. You can view an interactive map of Iraq's archaeological sites at our website, onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.